Okay, let's welcome our political commentators now to discuss MIQ and other matters. Shane Tapoor is in the Tamaki Makaurau Auckland studio. Kia ora and welcome, Shane.
Kia ora koutou.
Kia ora and welcome, Bridget Morton, in the Te Whanganui Atara Wellington studio. Lovely to have you here.
Morena.
Now, Bridget is a senior consultant with public and commercial law firm Franks and Ogilvie and a former senior ministerial advisor for the previous National-led government. Shane Tapoor is a former candidate, campaign manager and executive member of the Labour Party and a former union official. He's no longer a member of any political party but is still very much a commentator on politics. We'll get to the poll in a moment, but can we start off with the MIQ situation, Bridget? Look, we know it's hard. We know there's limited places. There's people trying to get home from Australia right now. There's the construction industry and others. The Auckland Chamber of Commerce, I think, saying they had 6,400 jobs they needed to fill just from a recent survey of their members. Yes, there's pressure on the system. But could we not have seen some kind of upgrading of how it works in 16 months?
Yeah, I think that's the factor, is that it seems so tone deaf of the government to just kind of put their head in the sand and go, oh, it's all too hard. When it seems that even if you say the whole big system in terms of, you know, the sort of lottery element, the people going on holiday, the people going to see family and friends, there's parts of it. So people, you know, taking medical treatment, seafarers who are coming in on boats, that kind of low-hanging fruit, can you not compartmentalise the system in some way that you have got a way of dealing with those people in particular, even if you can't yet see the solution to the bigger problem? And I think, you know, it's too late today for the Prime Minister sort of to be coming out and saying, oh, yeah, we're going to look at the reasons for compassionate...
What did she say this morning? This was on TVNZ.
Yeah, and she basically said, look, I think the grounds for compassionate... It needs to be lowered level, and they're going to look at whether they notify people of when rooms have been released. And it just seems a little bit too late, too late for there actually to be, you know, the groundswell of concern, because I don't know if there's anyone in this country who is not touched in some way by an MIQ story.
Look, what we were discussing with the queuing theorists and the technology commentator we had on is that it's not even a fair lottery. You know, if you can go and pay $2,500 to have someone do this for you, or to have computer bots or someone working in another country doing this for you, that's not even fair. It's not even fair as a lottery. But also, you can build in some prioritisation and have it automated. The queuing theorist was also saying, instead of having to sit and hit refresh 24/7, you could have a system that gives you a window that says, OK, you're trying to travel in this time frame. Here's what we believe the percentage odds are of you getting a room in this time. You could have notifications come forward. It's just so basic. And they're telling us it doesn't need to be. Shane?
Yeah, well, look, there's growing frustration. Very few spots available for folks. We're all thinking, why can't we sort out the system? And I think there are more bad headlines to come, to be honest. I understand that many of the bots, many of the third line sort of booking systems have been blocked. You can do that. You know, you build an algorithm to do that. And I think, you know, that whole user experience improvement needs to be fixed up. But I think the average Kiwi in many ways looks at it and says, yes, it is a complex job. And on the whole, the government has done the right thing, and that's keeping us safe. But having said that, it is a mess. It is a growing mess. And the system around prioritising, particularly people who need medical help, particularly people who are coming to say their final farewells to loved one, need to be fixed. And if the government doesn't fix it, their winter of discontent will continue.
It's not just about there being a limited number of spaces, Shane. It's the underutilisation of spaces.
Yes.
And Newsdesk did this. Rebecca Stevenson reported on this for us on the show a while ago, and certainly did on Newsdesk quite extensively. They had gone back and said, look, where are your spreadsheets, MB, showing where the underutilisation was in the past few weeks? How are you analysing whether you are optimising and actually making the most of every available space? And I think the reply came back was something like, we don't look backwards. We don't look back at what's gone before. We replace the template and keep moving forwards.
Well,
are you going to improve any system if you're not on a path of improvement, given the fact that this system is with us to stay for quite some time?
You have to review, and it's easy to do because the information is there. There's a payment process around many of this, so it is there. So for them to say they don't look back, well, it is time to look back. Look, we get that this process was designed under an emergency in a real pandemic situation, but we've had 16. I agree with Bridget. We've had 16 months of pathway. And we need to get the system better. And if the government doesn't get it better, they will pay the price.
Bridget, It's also becoming clearer and clearer, given what's happening in Australia, most emphatically or most obviously to us, but further afield as well, that we're not going to suddenly have a vaccinated, 80% vaccinated population and then life's back to normal. This system is going to have to be part of our lives for a long way to come. Are you seeing or hearing any urgency to at least be looking about how it is operating?
No, and it doesn't seem so. It seems they're still running within this sort of emergency mindset, you know, that Shane sort of pointed out. They did build this system under pressure, and I think everyone sort of understood that. But it is, well, actually, how are we going to deal with this? Because I think everyone now is not naive to think that this couldn't happen again. You know, the Delta strain was, you know, unexpected. There's likely to be others. So, you know, in Australia, they're talking about, you know, more permanent MIQ type facilities that are used for other things. I know, you know, I mean, the opposition brought it up months and months ago. It was poo-pooed by the government, and then the government, I think it was last month, came out and said, oh, that is something we might look at. Some of these facilities that are currently there we could possibly use. But there doesn't seem to be any urgency around getting this sorted and getting this set up.
It's the same with the saliva tests. Again, we learned last week, now Rako, I think, the company that is producing one particular saliva test, the Ministry of Health has put out a co-statement exists on RACO's website signed by the Ministry of Health saying, yes, this is efficacious and reliable to this level. And, you know, it took 8 months to get this, Shane. This could have been supporting the nasopharyngeal, the nose jobs, for much, much longer than it has been. We seem to be stuck, even under the pressure that people are under, in an extremely slow and cumbersome response system.
Yeah, and I think, but I think to be fair, you know, you've only got a limited amount of people, human resource, limited amount of funding. You've got to deal with the immediate issue, and the immediate issue is having an MIQ system whose primary purpose is to keep us safe. It's been near perfect in that respect. The next stage does need to happen, and I think there does need to be a sense of urgency. But I think most Kiwis are pleased that there's been a level of robustness in terms of the MIQ process. And, you know, Bridget, all due respect, Australian comparisons at this point in time ain't the best analysis.
Yeah, but they are an analysis in terms of thinking about what are they doing. You know, they're further down the track in terms of, you know, they've got the Delta strain. Hopefully we never get the Delta strain here and we don't have the pressurised system they've got at the moment. But it would be stupid of us to go, just because you've got the Delta strain, that we can't learn from many of the other things you're doing. And that conversation they're having around permanent MIQ facilities is something that I think we should be discussing here.
They're also gone a step further. We ridiculed Scott Morrison's first back of the envelope, here's our pathway out of COVID, in part because it was announced the same day as he said they were halving the number of people they were letting into the country, and second because there was nothing on it. But they are now talking about the level of vaccination, and I think it's about 80%, which is looking like it's going to be comparatively low with this Delta variant affecting younger people. They're beginning to talk about how they are going to manage post their vaccination program, Shane.
And so, the Prime Minister has indicated today that next Thursday there's going to be a major announcement around that area. I think all government's timings are fundamentally different, but I totally agree that we need a pathway, and the Prime Minister indicated today that's going to happen within the next 7 to 10 working days.
All right. The question is the MIQ system ready for an upgrade to more sensibly deal with a situation that is going to be ongoing? Whatever happens with vaccination, there is going to be a need for some people to be able to actively use that system. Perhaps if they're not vaccinated or they come from a part of the world where they've had a different vaccine and New Zealand's going to have a different approach to it. We're going to need to have a system that works and that's fit for purpose, Bridget.
Yeah, I think, you know, looking at some of those questions that we keep coming back to, you know, around vaccine passports and things. In the UK, you know, you've got an app on your phone that you can show that you've been vaccinated, that people are using to go to the theatre and all that sort of thing. And we're just not really seeming to having those discussions here because we haven't even got yet to the people getting vaccinated sort of point of view. But I think the government, we're going to be left, you know, behind in terms of people are going to be frustrated that they're not able to travel or that we're going to have to go into lockdowns when, you know, other parts of the world have tools to deal with this. Why are we not looking at this more seriously now?
I'm with Shane on this, and that people are still primarily saying just keep that variant out. But I am with you also that I think the current MIQ situation affecting so many people, and with stories like this morning's, which I just personally find indefensible, and I'm just happy to say that. With these stories coming, people are looking for the incremental, okay, but how are you making what you're doing better? And we need to hear some more of that, Shane, because we're hearing a lot of stuff that hasn't changed over more than a year.
We got to get the balance right. The empirical data actually shows me that Kiwis are a lot more conservative on this issue in terms of border control than perhaps we are. And I think that's a leadership issue that the Prime Minister needs to confront.
It doesn't need to be an either or.
I accept that. What I'm suggesting is that Kiwis out there are a lot more conservative than what our position is. And this is a leadership question that the Prime Minister and her cabinet needs to answer.
But this shouldn't be a politics question, because what you're saying, well, what I feel like you're saying is that because at the moment Kiwis are going, actually keep our border secure, I don't want to travel, I don't want that Delta variant in, we shouldn't be looking at what that pathway out is. The Prime Minister actually has to look at look at the leadership and look at the infrastructure that they need to build so that when the public is there and there is that social licence shift, that they are ready to do so. I think you're absolutely right that people don't want our borders, you know, flowing open. They don't want a UK-type situation at the moment. But that is what the government is elected to do, is future-proof.
Shane, it's not about opening the borders. Yeah. It's about managing this incredible pressure on the system with the borders closed, this question. Yep.
And what we need a suite of answers. I think what we need to look at are things like just practical solutions like a vaccination passport, the ability for people to come into low-risk country, probably have saliva testing, be in for a shorter period, rely on people's goodwill in terms of some home-based isolation. I think the methodologies and the tactics will change. And, I'm in total agreement that our leadership, both the Ministry of Health and leadership and political leadership, need to develop the pathway.
Just finally, Bridget, do you get any sense with your, ears open around the Beltway, and Shane, you too.
Yep.
Some of this is to do with that old, hoary old chestnut of the public sector, private centre interaction. So RACO taking 8 months to convince and to get the Ministry of Health to agree on the efficacy, reliability of its saliva testing. You've got, as we said, tech people and queuing theorists saying, we will come and help you design a better MIQ system that includes some sane prioritisation. Is there still a reluctance to bring people into the tent with the necessary skills and ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it's been widely discussed, I'd say, over the last sort of 10 years, the problems particularly with the Ministry of Health as being fifed in about they won't allow, that external expertise into, informing their policies and the changes that they do. And we saw when COVID first happened, I remember that the Prime Minister had, I can't remember what it was called, but it was like a business advisory group or something along those lines. And there was people from the private sector helping to bring in PPE. And, there seemed like there was a change afoot. That seems to have all disappeared. And then once again, we're back to this reluctance of, involving.
You've got the Roach advisory group, Shane, but some of what the Roach advisory group has been saying for months is still waiting to be implemented too.
Yeah. Well, I think there's some extremely innovative private companies that have some great answers, some great solutions, and I agree with Bridget. There is that conflict between public and private sector, but the thing is that when you're dealing with a pandemic, when you're dealing with crisis, and I think we're going to be in this space for perhaps a couple of more years to come, you've got to use every resource that is available within your country to have the best outcome possible. Okay. You're not going to get perfection, but you need to work towards it on a unified basis.
Kia ora, Shane. Let's talk about the polls, because we're going to break all the rules, which is that you never take one poll in isolation. Unfortunately, they are so rare these days that you're left with little choice, although I see some marry up with what happened with an earlier Colmar Brunt, and perhaps with a little bit more recent unease fed into this one. What we're seeing, interestingly, is a bigger than previous drop for Labour, but it's not at National's gain. There's a modest 1.8 percentage point gain, I think, for National. It's ACT again that seems to be hoovering up this vote that's going, I'm less happy or I'm not happy with the incumbents. Perhaps I never voted for them previously anyway, and now where do I go? What do you take out of this poll, Shane?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think that Labor can't take middle ground for granted. I also think that if you look historically, not at the polls, but you look at historically and politically, when the centre-left party, the main centre-left party, is doing particularly bad, people who vote at the centre and to the centre-left look elsewhere within that spectrum. So that's what's happening with National, unfirm supporters. They're looking at ACT, so they're the benefactors of that. But you've got to give Seymour his credit. He is consistent in his approach. He doesn't get into the nitty gritty of the politics of the day. He's always pleasant in terms of how he answers things, and he's a clear there's a point of clear difference between him and Judith Collins. I think what we are seeing is perhaps one of the longest political death rattles in a long, long time, and that is of Judith Collins. The Prime Minister will be concerned. She will think that there's plenty enough runway between now and the election. And, you know, you've got to say that the coalition, both the Greens and Labor, still have a clear lead across the polls in terms of the alternative.
There's still over 50% as appearing,
yeah.
Bridget.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think you can move away from that. The thing that I find really interesting is kind of some of the commentary around this poll. You know, there's a lot of discussion around ACT, you know, rising up and, you know, whether or not, you know, that's the new opposition leader and the new opposition party. I remember during the key years, there was this concern that was sort of every couple of weeks would be like, well, National was never going to sustainably be in government if they can't find a solid coalition partner. Now there is a very solid coalition partner, and you can see that reflected in ACT's media that's going out, that what they're saying is, look, there is actually a pathway to government on the right here. This is what we're doing together. I think it's really smart politics from them.
They're about 40%, I think, combined in this poll, from memory.
Yeah, do some back of the envelope maths.
Yeah, you carry on, I'll do the maths.
So that's, I think, and that's what they need to see. They need to be seen like they're an alternative to government. And ACT is doing a really good job of that. I think National is stabilising and they will grow on the back of this sort of winter of discontent, as, you know, Shane called it earlier, that's happening for Labor. I thought also particularly interesting, you know, that growth and vote for New Zealand First,
yes,
is a pretty good indication
3.4.
That people are unhappy with what's happening in the current government. And I think also, you know, there was lots of complaints under the previous government about, you know, New Zealand First holding up policy, but actually they were a voice, and then, you know, they were holding back Labor from some of these, you know, kind of more progressive decisions that the middle doesn't like.
Go ahead, Shane.
I think to say that people aren't happy with this government is an exaggeration, to be honest, Bridget. You've got the Prime Minister at 45% comparative to, what, 10 or 11 in terms of both Seymour and Collins, and you've got a coalition that's still 10 plus percent ahead. So to say that people are unhappy, I think that the middle ground is shifting. I certainly accept that, but I think overall the government has the coalition government has the support of New Zealanders.
Well, they're doing things, Shane. They were criticised for a whole term for doing nothing and holding reviews. Now they are doing things. They're doing things while they are a majority government, which is when you do things if you're ever going to try and do them. They're going to have to wear some of the reaction from those who, across a whole suite of issues, are finding things too hard or too disruptive or affecting them personally.
Absolutely.
But they are doing things.
But here's the other thing that will be happening as we speak. A National Party caucus members will be thinking, we are slowly getting there, but we're not near enough, and we're not going to get there under Collins. And the drums in terms of the leadership change will continue to beat, and they will continue to beat louder and harder, in my view.
Here's another thing. 28.7% National is, to Bridget's point, the centre-right option is now at 40%.
Mm-hmm.
That is something they will be celebrating. The question is, how do they make up the next 6 to 7 percentage points you need to get to that point with wasted vote of potentially becoming a government? Are they going to keep fighting over the same voters? Does National need to strategise over where it is going to recoup most of its vote without sucking them away from ACT?
Yeah, I think we've got to be careful here. I heard a commentator the other week talking about how, you know, they were fighting over the same ground because they were both talking about law and order, as in if that's a right-wing issue, and it's not. And I think you've got to be really careful, particularly in New Zealand, where our spectrum of politics between the left and the right is actually not that long. It's not that wide. You actually, the nuances are sort of there. So I think there's a lot of people, you know, that will shift between ACT and National quite a bit. And what I think is more interesting is actually you've got those sort of swing voters, that soft centre, as Shane was referring to, sort of, you know, some of them are actually going around National and going to ACT at the moment. I think those are the people that National was more worried about, because why are they not seeing National as a place to put their support
but
or their
that's
vote
my,
right now?
That's my point. Mm-hmm. If National gets to a point where it is seen as credible again by many people who are not currently supporting it, is that going to come at the expense of some of those who've gone from ACT? Or do
undoubtedly.
To fight Labor head to head on the centre ground.
Absolutely. I think what we've seen at the moment is we're seeing a shift from people who don't have faith in the national leadership, don't have faith in national, they're centre right voters, and they're going to act. And when Labor's weak, way back they'll go to the Alliance or they'll go to Green. So you know this is not a new phenomenon. And National has been, by and large, embedded on peripheral issues, he pūapua, the issue around what is a New Zealand citizen. It's the mainstream issues, the economy and the growth of the economy that voters are interested in, and I don't think they've hit the mark on that dial yet.
Well, let's get on to it, and that's why we were also saying do not write off New Zealand First, because when a very dominant party of either side of the aisle begins to get into the hard yards of government and the shine comes off and the numbers come off, that's when these smaller parties get their chance. Yes. Let's look at some of what's really niggling at the moment. The nurses and the police pay rounds. Shane, I want to come to you at this pent-up anticipation. Yep. The nurses... their own union, the minister says, voted against its own proposal, but actually that was the members voting against that proposal, which might tell you something about the mood of nurses out there now. Is this potentially a good news story for Labor if it comes through with, a significant boost, or does it raise expectations for the whole public sector at the time you've got an inflation bogey looming?
Well, both. To be honest, but I don't think that I don't think increased public and private sector wages are having the biggest impact in terms of inflation, which seems to be going up across the world. I don't think there's too much distance now between the government and a settlement. I've been involved in union negotiations. Sometimes you need to make a second bite of it, and the second bite isn't that tough. The government has moved significantly. My understanding, doing the calculations, that there's probably close to $1 billion worth of resourcing and increase in wages for the nurses. So I don't think they're far off. Look, I'm a union guy. I support the nurses, but there needs to be some reality in terms of a settlement position, and I don't think they're that far away from it, to be honest, Catherine.
The other reality is the staffing shortages, which they're particularly toey on Bridget, because they just don't feel that's ever getting dealt to. In fact, they want penalties brought in for district health boards, penalties for dangerous or understaffing levels. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you talk to a nurse in some of our biggest cities at the moment, trying to find affordable accommodation anywhere near where they work, Bridget.
Yeah, and I think that's the factor, is that you can't look at it just in isolation. It's a lot about this cost of living argument that goes across, I think, every sector at the moment. I don't think any sector is unaffected by a housing supply issue. You know, everyone's struggling to get workers in the right spots at the right time. And I think what's really interesting here is I always reflect on the sort of dynamic between the unions and Labor. You know, the unions will always... vote and will always, put their support behind Labor at the election time, which gives them less leverage, in between times. And I think it's really interesting to see, a union leader like Andrew Little, former union leader, like him coming out and sort of going on this direct attack, it seems, on the nurses. He hasn't held back, on terms of keeping this behind closed doors. He's put all the pay negotiations up, which is, I understand, quite an unusual move. He's, talked about, he's kind of ridiculed the unions a little bit, pointing out what you did before. That the nurses themselves voted against
it. That's the negotiators. It's not their members. Their members that's a message from the members to the negotiators saying, do better.
Yeah, and this is the rhetoric, that I think it's just interesting that Andrew Little is happy. Well, I wouldn't say happy is probably the right word. He is, content enough to go out and actually attack these union leaders because he knows it's actually not going to change any of the support come next election.
Well, no. Well, I don't think that's his view. That's the reason that he's doing this. I think the reason he's doing it is quite simple, that the public will understand that there isn't an unlimited amount of money, and a good deal for nurses creates expectations for teachers, etc. And as I say, I don't think they're far away from doing this deal. There's been a major move from this government. Let's just reflect in terms of the last Labor government. There was an increase in nurses' wages by 25%.
20 years ago. Then we saw
very little movement under the last National government. A slight movement by this government and before these negotiations, and we're looking at about 11 to 12% increase. So it's not as if this government has been tone deaf to the needs of the nurses in the public sector.
That staffing issue is a big part of the claim, and I think it also goes to the fact.
And it's a long term solution.
It also goes to the fact that the public sector has grown by 10% under this government, and how do you measure what a nurse does against what others in, I don't know, one agency's got 72 people in its comms team, which has about made me fell off my chair. There's a couple of newsrooms as far as I'm concerned. You know, this is the other matter. Are they in a different category?
Yeah, well, this is interesting, I think, around, you know, going back to that extraordinary announcement that I've never heard anyone be able to explain why Labor came out and said there was going to be a pay freeze for the public sector when, you know...
Maybe this was why.
But this is the thing, that you, yeah. they say this, well, but now they're negotiating this, you know, yeah. these increases here. Whereas you see in Wellington, there is so much growth in the public sector that anyone who wants a pay increase just swaps agencies. There's huge movement happening between agencies here. It's not a problem, you know, in Wellington, it's not hitting the people sitting at the desk, which is, I think, what Labor thought when they made that blanket announcement.
But they were not explicit about teachers, police officers and
nurses. The reality having been in the game of recruitment and retention, there is only one way to really increase your recruitment and retention capacity, and that is to offer better wages and career pathways.
And
it's that type of settlement that will fix this problem.
Okay. One very brief take from each of you on the sure. Supermarkets and the Commerce Commission report that came out and was just completely blunt about it. Yes, there's a duopoly. Yes, it restricts competition. And yes, it means people are paying too much for their groceries. Well back in the queue, but on the list of possibilities, if other measures don't work, was forcing some kind of a split either between wholesaler and retailer or perhaps having to sell off some stores. I think it was Catherine Rich of the Grocery Council that called it the telecom moment. Is it, Shane?
It is the telecom moment. Look, the Grocery Council having moral high ground on this issue, I don't accept that, actually. The reality is that report came as no surprise to anybody. And if the industry doesn't fix it, we will have to look at get some form of government regulation. We have massive and growing food insecurity in this country. I don't blame in isolation the supermarkets, but they do need to fix it. And you know what? If they don't, perhaps we do have to do something radical, quite radical, and look at maximum wage prices for goods of priority. You know, the staple goods that people can't live without. I don't want to go there. The challenge is to give the industry the opportunity to fix it.
Structural separation might be a more comfortable place for any government to go, but that return on investment, the Commerce Commission pointed out, wasn't very high. Bridget?
Yeah, I think this is a massive political test for David Clark. You know, he has a lot of ground to make up here after the debacle of last year at the beginning of sort of lockdown. And I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of calls from the left, you know, reflected in Shane's commentary here, of some sort of regulation of the supermarket, you know, game, and, you know, a lot of people that are going to push back quite heavily against that. But ultimately, it goes to the core narrative of Labor, which says they're doing stuff about, you know, poverty, that they're, you know, dealing with these issues about people living, you know, at the bottom. And they're the ones most affected by high food prices. They've got the least flexibility. And I think, you know, if David Clark doesn't do anything, it's going to be yet another fade for him. But I think if he does anything, there's huge risk in it.
Okay, thank you both. Much appreciated. Kia ora, Shane Tapua, and also Bridget Morton.